Okay. Well, it's my very great pleasure to welcome you to this series of talks. We acknowledge the lands and the elders of the lands on which we're speaking and on which you are all based. But I'd like to first introduce Dr. Giovanni Arca, who was one of our wonderful group of graduates who presented a wonderful doctorate in 2019 at Monash under the supervision of Dr. Ian Mabbutt and others. And his background is in studies on Indo-Tibetan culture, religions of the Far East. His research is on various issues, Western cultural transfer on the Indo-Tibetan religious culture, the misinterpretation of tantric Buddhist iconography, and neurocognitive studies of meditational experiences. So he's published academically on the origins of Mahamudra, the influence of Western esoteric currents on Tibetan religious traditions and beliefs. And he's published in a non-academic way on topics related to Buddhism and Tibetan medicine as editor and author. His last non-academic publication this year has been within a multimedia project funded by the Italian Ministry of Cultural Heritages and Activities, for which he has authored a 45-minute podcast on the tantric transformation of physical items and structures into sacred religious objects. And these are available also on Apple Podcasts and SoundCloud. Very impressive, clearly on a higher level than technically where I am. But many thanks, Giovanni. We look forward to you're going to speak to us on death and birth in Buddhism, the circular motion of illusion. Over to you.
Thank you, Constant. So before getting into specific details, I would like to start in a bit indirect way, which is, however, rather relevant for the Buddhist perspective on transmigration, saying that the main reason why almost everybody is interested to know if something happens and what happens after death seems linked to the idea that all we know about is life. And the end of life seems like a jump in the dark. But a concept that is quite connected to the Buddhist understanding of the world is that in reality, we don't even actually know what life is. What is this thing that we call universe? What any kind of existence fundamentally is? We are still trying to figure out the nature of what we call reality and our life as a part of it. There's been a very recent article by Andrew Ponson, who is professor of cosmology at the University College in London. And he said that we should think at galaxies, for example, not so much as we have done up to now, like a sort of predictable machines, but rather more as animals, auspicating a shift from a somewhat restrictive Newtonian physics. Well, this is just an example to say that although it appears that when we die, we are leaving a comfortably familiar place, we should perhaps acknowledge at a deeper level that the existence is still a mystery as much as death, especially when, in a Buddhist perspective, we may think that our experience of reality is fundamentally unreal. So, this talk is about Buddhist perspectives on the afterlife, but much of what I will mention from Buddhist sources has a highly transcultural value and can contribute to a general investigation about the nature of reality and the self. And I will address this mainly in the first part of this talk. So, what is first of all important to say in terms of a general Buddhist approach to the topic of death and rebirth is that this investigation cannot be separated from the question, who and what does actually die? This means that in Buddhism, as well as by ordinary logic, any possible attempt to answer this question mainly depends on defining if and what kind of self exists, how existence itself is perceived, and if this perception allows for any possible assessment of what you call reality, or if it does not. So, in the time I have, I will try to provide some insights and reflections on how these topics have been discussed in a general Buddhist perspective, and how they connect to death and rebirth. You will see that I will often refer to some analogy with modern physics. Those who study or are more familiar with Buddhism, and especially Tantric and Vajrayana Buddhism, know that this is not uncommon, and it has actually become almost trendy in the last few decades. I'm not doing it because it's trendy, but because there are really impressive points of contact between many concepts present in Buddhist philosophy and cosmology and physics. In particular, the quantum theory and the wave and field theories. You don't have always to be a mathematician to understand the basic notions of these theories. And the way and the pace these frontiers are expanding are also offering new perspectives and definitions which can widen the ones already present in the language of religious and philosophical studies. I hope there will be further opportunities in this regard in the second part of this seminar series to present the scientific analogies within the topic of death and rebirth. As I believe it is quite expected, in Buddhism, there are different traditions that have elaborated different doctrines. But if there is an element that provides them with the common ground, is precisely the concept of rebirth. It has been said that Siddhartha Gautama, who is generally known as the Buddha, simply adapted to the cultural environment of his own times, and that rebirth might actually be only a shortcutting and perhaps a superfluous element in his teachings. But this contradicts the fact that the various religious systems at that time had very different ideas on the after death, the spirit, karma, and rebirth. So there was not at all a homogeneous religious environment to which one could actually choose to conform. When Siddhartha Gautama was very directly asked in the Ananda Sutta, the Samyutta Nikaya, if anything like an individual self existed, he simply did not answer. In another much later sutra, perhaps written by Hasvaghosha in the first or second century CE, rebirth becomes directly connected to the illusion of a self. Although this too was considered a kind of an unnecessary and misleading conceptualization. The question of whether or not, and to what any possible extent and perspective, Buddhism recognizes the existence of a self has animated a never-ending debate, which is still alive nowadays. There are different reasons why this question is still open. One reason is related to the apparently neutral approach of Siddhartha, who generally adopted an apophatic and elliptical way of speaking in that regard. And in a famous dialogue with his disciple Ananda, he says that he does not want to provide a response because that would either support the view of an eternal soul or the materialist perspective, or it would simply confuse people. Another reason is that this kind of no answer of Siddhartha may be interpreted not only as his pragmatic way of avoiding unnecessary distractions on the Buddhist path, but also inferred as a strategic yes-no answer, meaning that in the process of death and rebirth, the composite cluster of energy, matter, cognition, and consciousness that forms living entities like us can be subject to a complex array of variables and possibly concurrent factors, which would only be reductive and misrepresenting if described through a logical process, whether by inclusion or exclusion. But I think that the main reason is connected to different translations of a few key words whose interpretation has proved to be doctrinally crucial. The intricate debate about the self and also about its problematic conceptual relations with rebirth may have in fact originated from successive different interpretations of Pali words that express interrelated but possibly distinct values of permanent and constant. In particular, the word anatta as the negative definer of the Atman, the pre-Buddhist concept of the non-relative and non-created essence of existence, present in any form of life, including human beings. What we can reasonably argue in the context of the early documents of the Pali Canon is that the self has a composite nature, which we can define as ordinary and non-ordinary. The ordinary self is shaped by both karmic traces and impressions left by experiences through our senses and the mind processes, including various types of emotionally driven clinging. This is the self that Siddhartha considered as impermanent and illusory, and the one responsible for continuing the karmic shaping of future rebirths. But Siddhartha never explicitly negated any idea of the Atman, and therefore we can also argue for the presence of a non-ordinary or ultimate self, an Atman that is not to be intended as a personal and exclusive soul or an individual ego, but as a non-differentiated and non-dual nature, which is nevertheless in a non-created and trans-temporal identity and coexistence with both the relative self and the non-relative dimension, also called Dharmakaya, a concept that has also inherent strong cosmological connotations. Siddhartha was apparently not interested in any speculation about the existence or non-existence of an individual and permanent self. In the Sabbasava Sutta, in the Majjhima Nikaya, Siddhartha almost forcefully highlights a list of questions that, according to his opinion, do not bring anywhere, except to being distracted from the path. It is interesting that all these questions deal with who or what we are, past and future lives, and our connections with that. And he defined this question as a kind of thick bush or chains that represent nothing else than as many causes of recurrent birth, distress, aging, suffering, death, and rebirth. Buddhism takes instead much interest and care to the process itself rather than to speculations on the process of death and rebirth, and to connecting the cycle of death and birth to the actions, because the actions are both what leads to rebirth and what it may allow us to liberate from rebirth. The main reason why Buddhism is phenomenal and pragmatic is that it considers philosophical inquiry not useful if it is just an intellectual pursuit, but only as a methodological aid to the experiential knowledge. Rebirth is certainly a staple element in Buddhism. However, it is also true that it is largely derivative and not at all a central episteme. In other words, birth as we intend it is considered in Buddhism just a part of a more general and much wider concept of bhava, a Sanskrit word that can be effectively translated as becoming, as well as an inevitable consequence of a type of relative disturbance occurring in an otherwise immutable, non-created, and undefined state of reality. It is in this sense that Buddhism does not see birth as a particularly felicitous event, but rather as the inevitable outcome of a phenomenal process in which we are both the subjects of actions and the object of their consequences. Because of this, we could metaphorically say that we are at the same time the victims and the perpetrators. This concept of birth, however, does not apply only or even mainly to living beings, but it must be also intended more broadly as a cosmological constant of change, a becoming whose interrupted coming to be forms the phenomenal existence at large that can be seen and experienced at different levels, and of which we ourselves are a part. In a Buddhist perspective, birth can be identified with relative existence, intending any birth, those of a living cell, a baby, a planet, a galaxy, or the universe itself, all living or not living, cognizant or non-cognizant forms of existence that have somehow started, that had a kind of birth, and that inevitably will have an end, and so will die. In order to correctly consider any analysis of birth, death, and rebirth within the Buddhist context, it's important to understand that there are two equally valid and central points in Buddhism, both also points of origin of the Buddhist teachings. One is doctrinal, educative, and pragmatic. The other is immanent and can be defined as ineffable, meaning that cannot be expressed or described with ordinary means of communication. The first central point is what Siddhartha Gautama identified as suffering. And it is a factual starting point of what is called the Buddhist path, which is nothing else than a proactive engagement in knowing more about ourselves and the existence of which we are a part, according to the early teachings of the historical Buddha and their doctrinal and psychophysical expressions, including many kinds of yogic psychophysical techniques. The second central point is instead an inexplicable, non-dimensional, non-phenomenal, and non-temporal potentiality, which is nevertheless inherent to all possible dimensions, phenomena, and time. Thoughts cannot grasp it, words cannot describe it, but despite the resemblance with the qualifications of the divine Abrahamic entity, it is not God. But nevertheless, the absolute fundament of all relative and phenomenal existence. Rebirth has become one of the most popular topics of the Buddhist socio-religious narrative. But Siddhartha Gautama was very pragmatic and constantly referred to the law of cause and effect, implied in the already ancient Indian concept of karma, which entails the idea of the interdependence of every phenomenon. This doctrine can also be well related to the concept in modern physics regarding the interdependent and co-generating chain of matter and energy. And in fact, Siddhartha always directed his audience to the concept of becoming, which produces a kind of friction, a stress, generally defined as suffering, as a consequence of being ignorant of the non-generated and undivided nature of reality. That life brings stress, suffering, is indeed a cardinal concept in Buddhism. And it is strictly connected to any possible dimension and form of rebirth. So this stress is determined by actions, but not only in a moral sense, and not restricted only to the actions of living beings, but also as a more universal principle of motion, of any expression of kinetic energy involved in any kind of becoming, including birth. So the concept of suffering, upon which all the Buddhist edifices founded, cannot be interpreted in an only restricted everyday sense. The roots of this concept run deep into the meanings of attachment and desire, which run even deeper into those of illusion and relativity. Its ramifications extend to the world of physical processes and to the causal engine of interrelated phenomena, which is in turn linked to the concept of karma, to the equivalent laws of cause and effect, the perceived reality, and the elusiveness of energy forces and fields, well known, for example, to modern subatomic physics. The Pali and Sanskrit word dukkha, which is usually translated as suffering, is actually directly connected also to a relevant meaning of imbalance, an instability, which is the indispensable condition for the creation and multiplication of subsequent phenomena. Something similar to the idea of chaos, which was already known to Aristotle and is largely considered today in many disciplines and models. When you say creation, in this case, it's not intended as a positive event, but just as an imbalance, which manifests its resulting phenomena on every scale, from the physical cosmos to the human and any other form of existence. Taking another example from modern physics, it seems very much like the state found in early quantum fluctuations, which now seem progressively more at the origin of our own physical universe. According to Buddhism, death is just another experience, and generally not the end of experiences. Just like birth is an experience of aggregation, of basic elements forming a new life, death is an experience of dissolution, of disintegration of those elements. And the whole cycle of death and rebirth is a series of countless variations of phenomenal relative experiences. The almost totality of these deaths and rebirths consists in a complete disintegration of any continuity of individual consciousness. An infinitely small number of them results in forming living entities with some cognitive ability to question and investigate their own existence and the nature of reality itself, like it happens in our case as human beings. And in an absolutely negligible number of births, some living beings may show bridges of awareness, connecting them to the infinite waves of existence that we usually define as previous lives. According to Buddhism, Siddhartha Gautama was one of these latter individuals, and some highly qualified Buddhist practitioners, as well as other rare individuals, are also deemed capable of having different degrees and quality of awareness of elements connected to the previous forms of existence, which for them are still consciously present and contributing to their birth at the time of their own new biological conception. According to Mahayana teachings, those who have gained control over the process of death and rebirth can choose to be reborn to benefit all sentient beings. But this last thing is a specific topic that would require much, much more time than we have today, just to be at least generally outlined. So the whole process of death and rebirth has been the object of extensive elaboration in later doctrinal developments. And it finds its most complete expression in the Vajrayana tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. In the West, this is mainly known through a body of teachings that become famous with the name of Tibetan Book of the Dead. But the original title in Tibetan translates in reality as liberation through hearing in the intermediate state. And as the title suggests, the process of death is analyzed in the different stages of the disaggregation of the physical elements and the state and stages between the previous life and the next. The original text is very detailed and published in many different translations and editions. If anyone would be interested, I can give a link through the website, and I can provide some references to editions that are more reliable and more representative of the original Tibetan text. Regarding the existence of an afterlife, again, it is all a matter of establishing what we actually mean by that. If we mean the existence of our own self, like an individual person, Buddhism does not fundamentally contemplate anything like that. Because this would entail the existence of an ego-shaped individual singularity, transmigrating from a life form to another. What we call I are physical and cognitively assessed identity and singularity is defined in Buddhism as just an accumulation of impressions, like tracks on sand that will be washed away by the next wave. However, Buddhism acknowledges rebirth in different realms of relative existence or dimensions, among which the human life. And death itself is considered an experiential process. Although we can say that Buddhism recognizes an afterlife, meaning some form of existence after this life, this way of proceeding does not really work in a Buddhist perspective. The main point in Buddhism is, in fact, not concentrating the attention on what will happen after we die, but on the process itself, on what happens why we are dying, and on what drives us to being reborn, which can be seen as driving some traces of what we call I into another stream of relative existence. When advanced Buddhist practitioners apply some meditative techniques, what they do is attempting to purify their psychophysical dimension, experiencing as much as possible the dissolution of their relative perception, or either developing an integration into a non-relative state of mind. In both cases, this is a kind of death to the ordinary experience of reality. In Buddhism, we may actually speak of constant and innumerable deaths and rebirths that happen every instant on every level of existence. To posit a continuity between death and rebirth in Buddhism may seem in contradiction with the doctrine of no self. But only if by self we mean exclusively our relative experiential accumulation of impressions, which forms an illusory transient identity, which includes our physical dimension. But if we postulate that the self is the corruption, the disturbance of an original immutable matrix of pure potentiality, unexpressed, but from which everything can manifest, and we are able to access the source of our ordinary mental constructs, which is considered being somewhat behind the ordinary mind, and consciously and permanently remain in its recognition, well, then our relative self is removed from our existence, and we become able to avoid rebirth. And so, in a typical Buddhist perspective, to avoid suffering. And if this process is not complete, because we die again before we are able to do that, according to the traditional view, our previous training and or life experiences will represent a relevant part of the energy traces that will contribute to our new phenomenal existence, traditionally called karmic traces, therefore shaping our new life in ways and circumstances that will likely be more favorable to, for example, introspection, and possibly to encountering teachings and practices that will help us to continue on the path we have begun. In the Brahmacala Sutta of the Digha Nikaya, it is also reported that Siddhartha Gautama considered his own death as the final release into a state where he would not be seen anymore. A similar concept occurs in the Anuradha Sutta of the Samyutta Nikaya, where he states that the conscious principle of one who is liberated from the cycle of death and rebirth cannot be located anywhere. The Sanskrit and Pali word for this existential cycle of birth, life, death, and rebirth is samsara, which describes an idea of flowing, wandering around, with an implied strong connotation of universally changing continuum. And in a complementary view, the meaning of the word can also be referred to a cycle of growth, decay, reabsorption, and regrowth. In another sutta of the Digha Nikaya, the Attiraga, we find another example made by Siddhartha on the final destination of a liberated individual, described as rays of light that do not reach anything, anywhere, and just exist. The death of those who have ceased all attachments, internal and external, is therefore the absorption into a primordial, absolute matrix of what would appear to be a kind of conscious energy, beyond space-time and phenomenal existence. To make it clear that this state is not really describable, but can only be experienced, the reported words of Siddhartha Gautama depict a state that is clearly incomprehensible. And the words are these ones. One who has arrived at the final stage of liberation, after death, he exists. He does not exist. Both does and does not exist. And neither does exist and does not exist. So the only possibility that these contradictions may actually coexist is that the state Siddhartha is referring to is outside the cycle of death and rebirth, or dissolution and recreation, which means outside change, action, and any other aspect of any conceivable form of existence. This can only be classified as an undifferentiated, undefinable, and existential coincidentia oppositorum, where the laws of the observable or conceivable universe are not valid. And regarding this coincidentia oppositorum, as a kind of side information, Nicholas Cusanus, who wrote about this coincidence of opposites, interestingly said that it was the least imperfect name for God, whom he considered being everything just because there is nothing that God is not. It's quite an assessment strikingly similar to the Buddhist perspective, especially if we think that he came from a 15th century Catholic cardinal. The death of a common individual is instead considered very differently. The relative existence of anyone within the cycle of becoming, or death and birth, in absence of higher meditational skills and achievements, is subject in various degrees to the so-called wind of karma, the phenomenal chain of cause and effect related, and not only morally, to any action performed during their life. In Buddhism, life is considered as a circular chain of five aggregates called skanda in Sanskrit. There are inconstant, ever-changing causal dynamics, which renovates itself through itself like a self-devouring entity feeding on its own flesh, in an endless self-sustaining cycle whose main and inevitable outcome is always dukkha, that friction or stress that we usually identify and feel as suffering. The aggregates that form an individual are the body, composed by the four elements of earth, fire, air, and water, the sensations, the perception of external entities through the senses, the mental constructs, and the consciousness or awareness. The moment of death, all these elements disaggregate and dissolve, like rain absorbed into the soil, disappearing as rain, but nevertheless remaining dispersed into the earth. Or to make another example, we can think of ourselves as made of water, and then, like a drop, we are falling into the ocean. Yes, the water is still there, but it will be very hard to find it, and therefore very hard to talk about any remaining individuality. Anything we would commonly define as individuality will be gone. But actually, since in Buddhism, individuality is considered being a fleeting cluster of perception, an illusion created by our own karmic vision and attachments, it is only this illusion that is actually disappearing, because nothing we perceived as our solid and objective existence has ever been present in the first place. According to Buddhism, common individuals simply fail to recognize this, and therefore, at the moment of their death, an illusion is all that remains of themselves, like the fleeting existence of a drop of dew in the sun. However, when the Triptikas, which was a name to indicate people that were generally materialist and who were inclined to indulge in conceptual analysis, when they asked how it was possible that all human faculties and personality expressions existed without a self, and they had to be considered just illusions, the answer of the Mahayana followers was simply that an illusion is a mere analogy, and that beyond analogy, it is nothing to meditate on. Siddhartha avoided talking about that and mainly outlined that what happens in the past conditions the present, and the present conditions the future. A wise, but rather simple and common sense statement that is valid everywhere, every time, and for everything. Almost all fundamental Buddhist doctrines can be interpreted as both practical advice, existential explanations, and cosmological outlines. There is not any deep conceptual trench between laws of ethics and laws of physics, between morality and sociopolitical outcomes, between death, rebirth, and the aggregation and disintegration of the cosmos. The phenomenal cycle of existence that is called samsara is completely equivalent to the well-known law of the conservation of energy, which entails that new energy cannot actually be produced, but only transformed into different states. So death and rebirth are just part of a transformative cycle of energy, according to the waves and resonance produced by our phenomenal existence. In a wider Buddhist perspective, we are nothing more than fields of energy, which happen to be arranged in such a way to grant us a cognitive awareness of our own existence, similar to the scientific hypothesis of the presence of an energy system in the human body, and quite the same of the recent developments in quantum theory regarding the relation between matter and energy, and also of consciousness itself as a form of energy. Human life is considered precious in Buddhism, but not in itself, but just because we have the cognitive possibility of becoming fully aware of our own real nature, a nature that is to be intended as the objective fundament of our only subjective appreciation of reality. So according to Buddhism, human life is at the same time a cage and a precious opportunity. It is a cage because we are prisoners of an existence on which we have no control. We were born, we get old, and we die, whether we like it or not. And it is an opportunity because we have the possibility of assuming a certain control on the process of death and rebirth. In the so-called Buddhist path, people have to use what they have to reach a point where there is not an illusory I anymore, so that no one remains to perform any action, there is nothing to take, nothing to give, with a resulting zero balance of cause and effect of calm, and therefore no involuntary inertia to conflate again matter and energy, reproducing a rebirth and life. This is the necessary Buddhist epistemological background against which we need to consider death, what happens after death and rebirth. This has too often been compared to a kind of annihilation process. And the reason is that what has been considered for that assessment is only the relative self, the one which usually really dies, at least on a conscious level, although leaving traces that shape the following forms of existence. Again, all is very similar to how energy and matter work, but it shouldn't be a surprise, because in the end, we're also made of matter and energy. So I think that it's possibly becoming clear now, hopefully, that Buddhist traditions agree on the fundamental idea of one but double-layered existence. One layer is relative to what we perceive in our ordinary life, a kind of immense and ever-changing kaleidoscopic display of phenomena projected on an intricate background of time and space, where cause and effect create an uninterrupted chain of deaths and rebirths according to the karmic reverberations of all actions. And the other layer is an absolute non-conditioned existence. But the two layers of existence, absolute and relative, are not really separate. They are not in any relation of anteriority or posteriority, but are completely coexistent and, so to speak, interspersed. They are obviously different, since one is absolute, because immanent and non-generated, and the other is relative, because manifest and interdependent. But they are inseparable, because the absolute existence has an inherent, infinite, and timeless potential, and the relative existence stems from it like a reflection is generated by a mirror. This is the concomitant equality and difference of samsara and nirvana. Samsara defines the cycle of transformation of anything generated by the illusory appreciation of relative existence. Nirvana is a word that indicates the absolute reality as self-present and self-aware. And it is undefined because it is void of any manifestation, thus void of any becoming and transformation. Fundamentally, there is only one reality, but according to Buddhist practices, countless ways of not realizing it. So birth, life, and death in Buddhism are therefore different expressions of the same relative existence, and they are all directly connected to the law of cause and effect. But the law of cause and effect is also conditional to the presence of time, because it can only be applied to action, not to a static and immutable state, which would be timeless, because there would be no change, no movement, no action, no karma. But because birth, life, and death are actions that occur in a space-time continuum, it would be illogical to think that birth leads to life, life leads to death, and death does not lead to anything, which in Buddhism would in fact be considered a misconceived materialistic and nihilistic perception. Buddhists use the word relative, referring to our existence, because it is interdependently originated, developed, consumed, and rekindled, like the dying flame of a lamp that has no more oil, that is transferred to another completely full lamp. The flame continues to exist, but on another lamp with other oil, which is a metaphor of rebirth using the Milindapanya Sutra of the Kodaka Nikaya, which does represent a sort of continuity after death, albeit in a possibly counterintuitive distinction between what we have usually translated as transmigration on one side and rebirth on the other. The pivoting element in the metaphor is in fact a distinction between two words, sankamati and patisandahati. The first one, sankamati, is related to the meanings of going beyond, being transferred, and to possibly earlier acceptations of joining, going together, with semantic affiliation to ideas of bridging and going from place to place, all of which has generally been rendered in many Western languages with cognate words related to transmigration or reincarnation, which in the common usage is generally considered a synonym of metempsychosis. Transmigration, though, is a more general expression, meaning moving across places, while metempsychosis contains the Greek word psyche, psyche, which historically has been connected to ideas of individual spirit or soul. So because the word transmigration is commonly used as a synonym of being reborn and as an equivalent to metempsychosis, which usually entails the transfer of a spiritual individual singularity, as in the Abrahamic concept of a soul, it is common practice to avoid it in a Buddhist context and use rebirth instead. The other word of the dichotomy present in the Milindapanya Sutra, Patisandahati, conveys instead more specifically an idea of renovating, and it is usually translated as being reborn and considered a later synonym of another word, punabhava, expressing the idea of rebecoming, meaning rebirth in the sense of a renovated, regenerated existence. In the Milindapanya Sutra, the Greco-Bactrian king Milinda, or Menandros in Greek, roughly 350 years after Gautama Siddhartha, asks if it is possible being reborn but not transmigrated, that is, respectively, being renewed without implying a complete transfer of a previous existence. In other words, to undergo a process of patisandahati, rebirth, without going through sankamati, transfer. And the answer is, yes, it's possible, because when we transfer the flame, we do not transfer everything, but only what we could define as the most meaningful element of a lamp, the flame. If we go a little deeper in the metaphor, we can also say that the flame is somewhat undifferentiated, differently from the lamp, which can be made in different materials and style. And the flame connects also to the concept of a shared fundamental reality, like the element of fire is the real nature of all singular flames. But in any case, each flame comes from a specific lamp and not from another. And once this has happened, it is a fact that cannot be changed, like the personal relative existence of each one of us. So we have seen that in Buddhism, birth is the perceived separation from an undefinable and undifferentiated continuum of infinite potentiality. According to the Samyutta Nikaya, in a sutra on the analysis of the dependent origination of the relative existence, Siddhartha says that birth has to be intended as not only the event of being conceived and delivered, but in any sense that relates to coming into existence, manifesting quality and quantity, a perception and sensory perception in any form of being, including but not exclusively what we define as life. Birth is therefore identified as a more general coming into action, becoming entangled into the net of relative perception that we call reality. It is the Maya veil, a show that is not fundamentally real or whose reality is only relative to our limitations. It is in this perspective that death and birth are not more real than anything else in the show, although they are very real for us, until according to the Buddhist view, we become completely aware of this not only as a mental construct, but in a such a profound way that we are able to be integrated in the dimension of absolute existence that is traditionally called Nirvana. Considering death and birth in Buddhism as only or mainly referred to living beings would be no less a mistake than it would be considering the beginning and end of heart beating without the body to which the heart is connected. Birth and death are inherently present in everything, inhaling and exhaling, the seasonal cycles of nature, the waking and sleeping state, and so on. So we and the life we see are a part of this process, and it is the process itself that represents in Buddhism the only fundamental and universal constant of the relative existence. It is through this lens that the process of birth, death, and rebirth is considered. The Buddhist cycle of death and rebirth does not essentially have a universal eschatology related to the individual. Since there is no real eschatos, that is no final destination or time. Everything that falls under the perception of the senses, including cognition, is considered void of objective existence, and therefore is nothing but a dance of projected shadows, a bit like what happens in the famous Plato's allegory of the cave. But there is an infinite of relative eschatos, moving incessantly from time to time, from cause to effect, from birth to birth, energy producing masses and masses releasing energy. This constant change is what relative reality is, and it is this constant that defines the action, the karmic energy, which is what essentially fuels rebirth. That is also the cosmic energy, engine of the reality as we know it, of what samsara or relative existence is. Nothing is beyond that as a kind of separate place, a better or worse spiritual dimension, but everything happens within the coexistence of samsara and nirvana. That is within the motional on one side and the motionless, infinite potentiality of the absolute primordial and uncreated condition on the other. Death and birth are once again nothing else than an aspect of the cosmological becoming, a constantly moving process of change. In a non-monotheistic and non-creationist perspective, like the one present in Buddhism, asking if there is life after death is actually a question full of questions. For one, it implies that death is somehow not real. That is not really the end of life. And this may also dangerously blur the distinction between the two phenomena, often reducing everything to a kind of moving from one house to another, the next one possibly more comfortable than the last. And secondly, it does not define what life is, neither before or after death. And three, it may lead to question if might there be any unidentified kind of life also before any birth. Because if we posit some sort of life after death, why should we discard the idea there might be life also before birth? It is evident that the weak point in all these suppositions is mainly not defining what life is. According to different definitions of life, we will have different answers. So if we are talking about biological life, we can certainly see that the process of death entails our dissolution as biological entities. From a materialistic perspective, that's simply the end of the line, as our conscience is considered exclusively linked to our neurocerebral activity. Buddhism considers instead that the cerebral mind is the psychophysical manifestation of a form of energy that is the source of the phenomenal existence, including our body and mind. And this is another topic that it would take really too much to go into the detail. I'm trying to skip something here because it's late. The Samyutta Nikaya reports that Siddhartha Gautama claimed the non-evidence of any starting point of the cycle of relative existence, stating that its beginning is inconceivable. The latest hypothesis in modern cosmology also contemplated the possibility that the universe itself might be infinite, a hypothesis that bears the consequence that time might also be infinite, which is equivalent to say that it exists only relatively and subjectively. To conclude, the relative existence of almost infinite lives, deaths, intermediate states, and rebirths in the Buddhist cycle of creation and disintegration, or birth and death, or samsara, can be further imagined as a circular loop of points, where each point represents an event, an action, or any living entity. Every point follows a relative temporal trajectory. And if we could be an external observer, we would see that the sum of their relative motions is always zero, just because it is a circle. And as such, all the points cannot escape the cohesive trajectory that outlines its geometric shape, regardless of any motional direction within the circumference. A practical example of this is a runner on a circular track, who the farther he gets from the starting point, and the closer he comes back to that. But because the value of any point in the circle, or quantity and quality of any entity, is relative, it is also potentially infinite, as well as any relative distance we may assume between each point, and this makes the circle potentially infinite too. So this might be another description, more graphic and geometric, of the Buddhist cycle of death and rebirth, as a self-contained trajectory in which whatever we and our fellow living beings do, it's like we were always running in circles, like riding a cosmic merry-go-round, until we step out. And in that moment, according to Buddhism, we realize we were living in a self-sustaining illusion. And this is called, in fact, realization. So this is, in essence, how I see birth, life, death, and rebirth as conceived and represented in Buddhism, as mentioned in the title of this talk, a circular motion of illusion. Thank you.